Great. Thank you very much. First of all, I did want to just reemphasize what Barry said, that in certain situations, the accountants are more important than the lawyers. If you didn't hear that when he was here, I just wanted to reiterate that because we don't hear that very often as accountants. What I would like to do is talk about a couple of changes. As was mentioned just a moment ago, in November, the SEC came out with some rules on reverse merger companies and listing. Shortly after that, in December, they came out with another rule as well that has to do with our confidential filings. And I don't know if we have any slides. No slides? Almost. Aha. On December 8th, they came out with some rules about confidential filings. As many of you know, if you've been through the process in the United States, as a foreign company, you were afforded the opportunity to file your registration statement with the SEC confidentially, not have that be made available to the public, and essentially go through the review process, and then as you reach the end of that process, file your registration statement right towards the end of the offering process. That became public at that time, and you were then be able to list and be traded. On December 8th, the SEC came out and they significantly narrowed the opportunity for those confidential filings. And in fact, essentially they eliminated it for all but four or five specific situations. And those relate primarily to privatizations by foreign governments, to issuance of debt by foreign governments, to situations where it's illegal or it's against the law in a jurisdiction to make a public filing before you're actually listed, or if you're already listed on an exchange and it would be problematic to have a public filing that isn't effective on another exchange. So what does all of that mean? Essentially, with those limited exceptions, there are no more confidential filings. From the very beginning of the process now, a company will need to file their information with the SEC. Their registration statement will be public. It will be publicly available on the SEC's EDGAR system. Anyone can go in there and look at that. And then through the review process, as that registration statement gets amended, those amendments will also be public. Also of note is any comment letters received by the SEC as you go through that process will become public within essentially 45 days. So, not only will the registration statement be public, but also the comment letters, which previously had been confidential as well, received by the SEC will also become public information. So the days of essentially starting the process out, going through, deciding exactly what you want the structure to look like, potentially moving vessels in and out of an entity in order to get an optimum structure or to get the deal that you want, that's all now going to be public information, so it's going to be much more difficult or people, I believe, will be much more reluctant to go through that process with the Securities and Exchange Commission at this point. The rationale really that the SEC had for this was that over a number of years, the types of registrants going through this process has changed. The comment that they made was that 10 years ago, most of the companies that were going through the confidential filing process were already listed on another exchange and were merely trying to dual list with the SEC. However, now most of the companies that were going through the confidential filing process were only listing in the United States, and they felt that it was an unfair advantage, if you will, to those companies to have a confidential filing process for their initial U.S. listing. So that is that's really the biggest change we've seen in the last few months at the SEC as it relates to foreign companies. The next topic in the environment I want to talk to is not something that's happened, but something that is going to happen in the not-too-distant future. We've been talking about this for a few years, but about 4 or 5 years ago, the accounting gods decided that lease accounting needed to be revisited. And so over the last several years, they have been revisiting what lease accounting looks like and how that should affect companies both as lessors and as lessees. And that this has been an ongoing discussion now for about, as I said, 4 years. Last year, they proposed a standard out there which would become effective to change the accounting for leases. That standard received a lot of attention and a lot of feedback because essentially it requires that all leases now be recorded on the balance sheet, regardless of whether they're what we would historically have thought about as either operating or capital leases. So now what an operating lease where you merely have rent expense that you're paying and it runs through the P&L, suddenly that's going to be on the balance sheet both for the lessor and the lessee. Okay? The model received a lot of feedback, but both the FASB and the IASB, which are the standard setters, both internationally and in the U.S., have said this standard is going to go forward. They're not going to back off of this standard. They're tweaking it a little bit. We expect that within the next probably 8 to 12 weeks, we will see a revised standard coming out, which will essentially more likely than not be the final standard that we see. And so I wanted to walk through what it looks like, what we think things are going to look like, and how you might be able to prepare for the changes that are coming out from these new standards. Probably the easiest way to do this is to look at some balance sheets and P&Ls, both as they exist right now and as we expect they would exist under the proposed standard, and then think about what that means for you or for the companies that you're working with. So right now, if you're a lessee, if you're chartering in a vessel, essentially on your balance sheet, you have nothing. You have your regular assets and liabilities, and that's it. There's nothing recorded on the balance sheet associated for that lease, as long as it's considered to be an operating lease. Under the new standard, that's going to change. Now, the operating lease, which I don't know if you can see the little red dot here, you're going to record the right to use an asset, okay? So you're going to have a new asset on your balance sheet associated with that new lease, and it's a right to use the asset that you're leasing. You're also going to have a liability recorded on the balance sheet, which is the liability to make the lease payments under that lease. Okay, so where previously you had no asset nor liability associated with the leasing that was going on, now you're going to have both an asset and a liability. Now, the two of them net themselves out, so some people initially thought, okay, we've got a larger balance sheet. But one of the things to be considered is, what does this do to some of your ratios? Particularly if you have debt covenant ratios, this is going to be something that would be of interest to you. Because as you can see in this example, in the first situation, you had a debt-to-asset ratio of 0.9, or 90%. By grossing up the balance sheet and recording both the liability for the lease and the right to use the asset, that ratio is going to go from the 90% to 105%, or from 0.9 to 1.05. So merely by changing this accounting standard, we're going to see changes in financial statements, and that's going to change some of the financial statement ratios that are out there, both for lessees and for lessors. So this is, the lessee example of what this would look like on the balance sheet. Assets are higher now. Liabilities and equity are higher, and the total debt-to-asset ratio is up under the new standard. Okay? Now let's move for a minute to the P&L, or the income statement. Again, it was relatively straightforward under the current standards. You have rental expense. In our scenario here, let's just say it's $10 a year. That $10 was the rent you paid for the entire life of the lease. It was really easy to record. If you had a 10-year lease, every year for 10 years, you recorded $10 of rental expense. That went into your EBITDA as a rent expense, and everyone was happy. $90 of EBITDA, $90 essentially of net income in a simple example, and then some amount of EPS. Under the new standard, this is also going to change, and it's going to change because now instead of recognizing the rental expense merely as an expense, you're going to be amortizing the asset that you've put on your books, that $100 right-to-use asset, not as an expense, but as an amortization item, okay? So now, if you look at your P&L, your EBITDA went from being, let's say, 90 in our previous example because you had a rental expense to 100 because it's no longer considered rent expense that you're paying. It's actually amortizing an asset that you have on your books. Also, there's an interest component in the new standard where you have to recognize the interest associated with that rental agreement on an effective interest model, which means more interest at the beginning, less interest at the end. So you're going to see a change in your interest. In this example, in year one, EBITDA, as you can see, goes from 90 to 100. Okay, sounds like good news, right? However, net income, as a result of the higher interest expense, instead of straight line of $10 over the full year, you now have higher interest in the early years, lower interest in the later years. Net income's down, and so EPS is also down in this situation in your first year. Now, if you move later into the lease, those facts are going to change just a little bit. Your amortization of your right-to-use asset is going to remain essentially the same, but as you'll notice here, your interest expense goes from a higher number, I think we used 6 in the previous example, to a lower number, which means at the end of the lease for a lessee, they're going to have more net income than they would have had under the original scenario, and more EPS. So essentially, instead of a nice, predictable model under the current leasing system, you're introducing ups and downs depending on where you are in the life of the lease, which obviously, if you have a large portfolio of leases, it's going to become difficult to predict the mix that you're going to have at any given point in time. Some leases are going to be at the beginning. Some are going to be at the end. It may all work out such that it's all balanced out, but it may not. And so there's going to be an introduction of volatility into P&Ls as a result of this change in standards. Now, if we move quickly to the lessor accounting, in a balance sheet example here, you have a vessel, some other assets, and then your liabilities and equity. Relatively straightforward, clean balance sheet. Under the new standard, the first thing that's going to happen is there'll be a reclassification of all your lease vessels out of vessels and into what are referred to as residual assets, or essentially the assets that are leased that someone else is using. Also, you're going to have an asset recorded that's going to be the right to receive your lease payments. Okay, so now you've got some sort of fair value model that will come in. You'll record a right to receive future payments, and you'll also record a liability associated with the requirement that you have to provide those vessels over a period of time. So again, the balance sheet's going up. We have the same scenario that we had before where assets are up, liabilities and equity are up. And we can see that the liabilities to asset ratio again changes, in this example from 0.45 to 0.66. So again, if you have ratios in loan covenants or other places, this is going to be something that's going to be important to understand. And then the P&L for a lessor, again, it becomes much more complicated. Initially, you're going to see probably a decrease in your EBITDA, because a portion of what was previously rental revenue is now going to be associated with interest. So it's going to be moving out of EBITDA from revenue into interest. In the early years, again, that's going to be a larger number. So you're going to see larger net income, but lower EBITDA. And then in later years, you're going to see essentially the same EBITDA, but you're going to see lower net income as the interest amount goes down. So really, the point to make here is that companies need to start understanding this particular standard, especially as they're negotiating arrangements with bankers and others, because it's going to have a pretty pervasive effect on their financial statements. Things that may happen, you need to make sure that analysts and others understand what this standard is going to do. Not necessarily the mechanics of the standard. The analysts will understand that leasing standard changes. But as far as your particular entity goes, where are you with the mix? What do you expect to be happening with your particular financial statements as you implement this standard, et cetera? What is the impact that it may have on debt covenants? Do you have the ability to renegotiate those covenants? How does it play into those particular covenants? Another item that's going to be very important is that this standard will be required to be presented or adopted retrospectively. So all years presented in your financial statements will have to be presented under the same standard. So while this may be a standard that comes into effect in 2014, that would mean that your financial statements for 14, 13, and 12 would all have to be stated consistently. So you'd have to be looking at this for leases for all of those years. So it's going to be a rather large undertaking for a lot of companies to go back and look at all of the leases, look at where they are in their leases, and essentially reaccount for all of those leases once the standard comes out. Also, infrastructure processes around that and the IT systems, are they in place to capture this new standard and move forward? Suggestions for companies to look at: one, continue to follow the standard. If you weren't aware that the standard was out there, it's available. Talk to your accountants. They have access to it. They can talk to you about that particular standard and where it stands. Think about putting together a project team to keep track of this and make sure everyone's updated. Look at potential training that may be required for the new standard so that your accountants in-house know how to deal with things as this gets finalized. Again, this is not something that is going to be able to be achieved in a short period of time. It's not a 3 to 6 month project. This is going to require some forethought and some planning to implement over a period of time. Also think about, as I said, IT systems that you may have in place. If you outsource or if you're using a manager, are they on top of this? Do they understand what's happening here? Are you going to get the right information that you need for your financial statements, et cetera? So, again, it's a big shift in the standards. It's not just the U.S. standards. This is both the U.S. GAAP and IFRS. So if you think it's just going to be a change for the U.S. listed companies, that's not true. It's going to come into effect for both of them at the same time, and it's probably going to be come effective in the next not effective for probably 2 to 3 years, but you're going to have to start looking at it and assessing it right after the standard comes out, which is probably going to be at some point this year. So with that, I will wrap up. Hopefully we are close now to on time. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take those or deflect them, either way. Yes. To answer the first question, do we have all the answers? I don't even think we know all of the questions yet. So no, we don't have all of the answers. The standard, as I mentioned, is still out there preliminarily and is in flux. So could things change? Yes, probably a little bit. To your specific question about how you would account for a charter in a profit-sharing arrangement, yes, you are going to have to look at that for all of the years once the standard is adopted, both going forward and going back. But I don't think there will be a significant change in the profit-sharing component of that arrangement. To the extent that there's a fixed rate and then a profit share, you're going to account for the fixed portion of that under the new lease guidance. The profit share still probably isn't going to be recognized until you know what that is, until it becomes fixed. No, you would likely account for that prospectively once you know what that is. So you're not going to continually have to restate prior years for information that becomes available at a later point in time.
The objective of accounting boards is to provide clarity to the users of accounting statements. Do you think it achieves that result?
That is a trick question. I'll actually paraphrase what the chairman of the IASB said, Sir David Tweedy, when they were announcing this standard. He said it was his goal that at some point he flew on an airline that had the airplane recorded on its balance sheet. Okay, so on one side, there is a very strong argument that we have companies that are entering into leases and have a significant amount of commitments and a significant amount of assets that are never recorded in their financial statements. So the argument is that's very unclear. It's, if you looked at the financial statements of an airline, in many situations you wouldn't see any assets and you wouldn't see any liabilities, despite the fact that they had significant both assets in use in their operations and significant liabilities coming due in the future. On the other side of the argument is, I think, what you're getting towards, that how does this provide any clarity if suddenly you have volatility being introduced, if suddenly you have additional assets and liabilities on the balance sheet? That's a valid argument, and that's an argument that's been made by a number of entities. That's why the standard is actually being revisited a second time, is because of the number of comments that came in. They are still tweaking the standard. They're looking at that. But at the end of the day, I think we're probably going to end up with something very similar to what I described. And it's not going to be, unfortunately, it's going to be one size for everyone, but it won't fit everyone quite as well. So, yes.
Thank you. just a quick question regarding the accounting for the lease. In your example, the right to use the asset and the liability to pay the asset, you had exactly the same amount. It was accounted 100 and 100. What if you have a charter in which is totally under the money, like a damaging charter party where the company is a charter and they're losing a lot of money? Would you still account the right to use the asset the same number as the liability to pay the asset, or it will be actually reduced? So then you will not only have a change to the ratios, but you will actually have a significant impact on your balance sheet.
Yeah. My answer to that is I don't know. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten far enough now into a standard that we've explored a number of those situations. I could see an argument essentially both ways on that, and so that's probably one of the areas that would need to be more clarified, that, you know, would it exactly match up? You know, in the theory that the boards have put out, yes, it would exactly match up. But sometimes, as we all know, reality diverges from theory, and you get situations where it just doesn't make sense. And so that's something, you know, we'd have to look at the very specific facts associated with that and make a decision. So, okay. Thank you very much. And I think we're now back to Nikos.